Coming up on Life as a Festival.
We set out a zero landfill initiative this year. We set up like a trash lab on site where we've gone as far as even using, like, you know, we have these coconut trees on site and we have these palm trees. And then every now and then the coconut obviously falls to the ground and, you know, and the leaves, they need trimming or else they get too heavy. And so we've gone to the point of even reusing all that. We've collected all that and we're building structures out of that. So we're having a lot of fun, man. for me, this part, all this stuff is actually very fun. And actually, I hope my enthusiasm has come across because I think sustainability can be really fun. It really is.
My name is Eamon Armstrong, and this is Life is a Festival. This podcast is a celebration of thinkers and leaders who live their lives with the open-hearted, experimental joy of a festival. Each week, we converse in complete openness, in an ongoing quest to find those boundaries in our being and melt them into lofty horizons. Life is a festival, only to the wise. Well, hey, folks. I'm here today with Pete Ponbrepa, the co-founder of Wonderfruit Festival in Thailand. Wonderfruit is this incredible sustainability project dressed up like a festival. I went in 2017, I had the opportunity to speak there, and I was floored by not only these incredible environmental experiments and initiatives, but also just this beautiful showcasing of Thai culture. Loved it. And I've been wanting to have Pete on the podcast for a long time. He did not disappoint. For those of you who don't have a lot of time and just want the sustainability stuff, feel free to skip to about 25 minutes in. We do a little while of building a rapport, talking about Pete's life, talking about meditation. It's all awesome stuff. But if you have a limited amount of time and you just want to talk about carbon offsets, jump on in. On the podcast today, we start by talking about some experiences that changed both Pete's and my perspectives of the world. We talk about Pete's family. He comes from this incredible Thai business family, and they've got this deep history of environmental stewardship, which continues with Wonderfruit. We talk about Wonderfruit itself. We talk about this thing called TreeCoin, which was an experiment they did when I was at Wonderfruit. We talk about this experiment with empathy that they did last year. There's a lot of experimentation, you know, from rice castles to the young farmers doing local remedies. It's pretty cool. We talk about how Wonderfruit champions Thai culture, from the traditional Mulam music to the challenges of weaving together different cultures at a festival, you know, whether those are the expats or the local Thai people. We talk about offsetting the carbon footprint. And one of the things that it seems like I keep making resolutions because of this podcast. Well, I've made another resolution, which is from this point forward, I'm going to purchase carbon offsets for every flight I take. I feel like that's a big way that I'm not really showing up. And actually, carbon offsets aren't actually that expensive for flights, so it might be something to look into. Wonderfruit actually has a carbon offset calculator on their website, which is dope. You can check that out. Also, my friend Ryan recommended Nori.com as a place to purchase carbon offsets. So I commit to doing that moving forward. We talk a little bit about scaling the environmentalism of the festival, how we measure it, how we measure what happens after the festival. And we finish with, you know, what's new for Wonderfruit if you want to go to this incredible Thai festival that starts in December. As always, at the end of the podcast, we do a little music and then we have a little like how'd the podcast go. If you haven't been listening, I do that every time. It's just a nice wrap up to see if we accomplished our goals together. This week, I make a little announcement about a pretty cool thing that's happening for the podcast. And I'll make that announcement at the beginning of the podcast next week when I've signed on the dotted line, but there's something exciting happening for the podcast. And Pete asked me about it, so it pops up at the end of the podcast. If you have not yet joined the Life is a Festival group on Facebook, it's becoming a pretty vibrant community where we talk about what's happened on the podcast. I get your questions to bring them into the new podcast, recommendations of guests to have on the podcast. So if you're into this podcast, if you listen to it regularly, you want to be part of a community of people making life more like a festival, that's where we're doing it. Life is a Festival group on Facebook. Anyway, I really love talking to Pete. He's a charming dude and someone who deeply believes in what he's trying to do for Thai culture and for the world. So without further ado, here is Pete. All right. Well, here we are. I'm here with Pete. Pete, how do you pronounce your last name?
Pon Brat Pa.
Pon Brat. Wait, let me do it right. Pon.
Okay. Pon.
Pon.
Brat.
Brat.
Pa.
Pa.
And put that together.
Pon Brat Pa.
Pon Brat Pa.
And Pranit, and your first name is Pranit Tan?
Yeah. Pranit Tan in Thai, but Pranit Tan.
Pranit Tan. And you go by Pete. When did you start going by Pete?
Ever since I was born. So my dad is, so he's actually Catholic. So he named me after St. Peter, one of the disciples. But I'm not Catholic.
St. Peter was on whom the rock of the church was built, I believe.
Yes.
St. Peter was the rock, and that was the foundation of the Catholic Church. So
it's
quite a strong namesake for you.
Yep.
Well, Pete, so I always like to start a conversation by just asking you, what would a real home run podcast look like for you? What would you most love the listeners today to walk away with from our conversation?
So I've recently been listening to more podcasts, and I think the ones that are interesting to me, or at least the ones that, you know, are able to capture my attention, are, it's like a real conversation. So I think you're a huge part of this podcast, as so am I. So like some of the podcasts, I'm sure you listen to more than me, but it seems like more very, you know, like question and answer. And the good ones, you know, just seem like a very, very natural conversation that sometimes you want to jump into. So I guess like the outcome hopefully is that, you know, we achieve the latter and people want to jump into it even though they can't.
What's your favorite podcast?
I've been listening to a few lately, but there's a format that I really like called, I actually just discovered, called the BBC, the Island Disc. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
So it's an interesting format because they interview a variety of different people from different backgrounds, but the format is always based on for example, what was the first record you bought? And then it ends with if you were stranded on an island, what would you choose to have, both as a soundtrack and then items? So they use that to kind of like break, I think also to kind of, you know, because it's really good insight listening to like what type of music, like say, for example, you know, like, a musician, what was his first record or what impacted him in terms of music. And then they also play the track a little bit. They play like 1 minute of it. So, and then they go on into a regular form, you know, they go on into the interview and they ask, you know, perhaps more serious things. And then it breaks again and it just kind of like intercepts it with like, okay, by the way, what track did you take your first date out on or something like that? You know? So in between like a serious conversation, they have these interceptions.
Well, I think it creates some emotional modulation, you know, like it really taps you into joy, which means that if then we want to talk about that one time that your dad got arrested and it was really dramatic and it's really painful, you have already kind of bought into some kind of levity and nimbleness in the conversation. I feel like that may be, I like those kinds of questions. I just have two things that I always do, which is I ask you what a home run podcast would look like. And then at the end, I ask you how it went. Because for me, I just want to bookend, like, what do we want to do here? And then we try to do it. And at the end, we'll be like, well, did we do the thing? Or, you know, how'd it go? So
home run.
But, you know, actually, I was at dinner I was in San Miguel de Allende for Day of the Dead, and someone asked me, what would be the best question you could ask this table full of people? And I thought about that, and I came up with a question that I think would be a great podcast question. So perhaps we can start with what I think was the best question I could have asked that table, which is, what was the last experience that you had that changed the way you think about the world?
Changed, or I mean completely changed, or how would you define change? Like, meaning, like, say, does change mean like completely change my mind from like black to white, or change means perhaps evolve my thoughts?
Well, in this case, I'm thinking of something that's properly paradigm shifting. So I'll give you an example of one for me, and see how this resonates with you. So for me, the election of Donald Trump changed the way I thought about the world. Prior to the election of Donald Trump, so I live in San Francisco, I go to Burning Man, like I'm like pretty much your classic San Francisco dude. I got a podcast, I like psychedelics. And it took the election of Donald Trump for me to really see the way that many people in my country were suffering, and that they were suffering to the point that they made a choice that would completely confounded me. And so it wasn't that in that moment I had integrated the way that my perspective had changed. So it took a while to research and understand, okay, so wait, what's really going on in this country? Like, how could it be that this man was elected? But it was that moment that it kind of knocked me out of...
Right, created a fundamental shift in like the next part of your journey, basically.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And okay. And I do men's work, and I speak to men about masculinity, and recognizing the wounds of white working class men in America that I just didn't even really see from my West Coast bubble. It really took the election of Donald Trump, and it completely changed how I did men's work. And I got way less righteous about things. I like toned it all. I took a step back and went more with humor and a little more humility. So that's kind of the type of paradigm shifting. That's the way that I would answer that question.
I'm pretty sure that the most significant thing that I did that changed my outlook on the world would be starting Wonderfruit.
Okay.
We wanted to create a platform that would use art, culture, music to create impact. And, you know, it's easy to say that, I think, but then to actually really do it, and then to not only take that seriously, but also how that impacts, myself as an individual, the people around me, and obviously, the declaration that we had announced, which was we want to make impact. So that really started a very interesting journey for me, and it continues to this very day. And I think like that decision or to start Wonderfruit, it also resulted in a lot of aftermaths that I continue to resonate with.
What's an example of something that doesn't really relate to Wonderfruit, but that shifted in your life because you took on this environmental festival project?
Upon doing it, then obviously, we started out with like very basic stuff that's just like, oh, okay, let's look at plastics, or let's look at, recycling, and, that's like quite external stuff. And then along the way, I realized that, to really empower these things, then, a lot of these things, at least for me, has to be internal. And internal for me wasn't just like, okay, I'm very conscious of like my decisions and my consumption and, stuff like that. But it was a trigger to a deeper understanding of that. So then that obviously led to, stuff like meditation. And I've been doing this for some time even before, but I never took it seriously. I was exposed to it when I was very young, but I didn't really, understand how it related to me and how that relation would relate to me and how that would relate to, myself being more, like a better version of myself, you know, to, and then how that could exemplify my relationship with other people and with the environment and so on and so forth. So like meditation was one, even the search of, say psychedelics or ayahuasca was another. And these things kept on triggering, that exploration within myself, and also how that relates to my relationship with the external world that we live in.
So you started meditating, and it sounds like you had an ayahuasca experience after you launched Wonderfruit as part of your personal growth to therefore be able to lead this project. Is that correct? Am I getting that right?
So the meditation I've been exposed to for a long time, but I've never, it never like kind of clicked to me. I mean, I liked it, and I felt that, okay, it was very peaceful and calming, and I could understand the clear benefits of doing it, but I didn't hit that moment, but then
describe that moment to me. What does it mean when it clicks?
When we recognize the benefit of it. When you recognize I think there's a couple of things, like, perhaps on a more spiritual level, the alignment of the energy and how we feel, but then on a very practical level, how that actually benefits myself, my relationships, my thoughts. And but ayahuasca was new because ayahuasca was like 4 or 5, I think 4 years ago or something. I've heard about it obviously a lot, but then never took the plunge. And then so like 4 years ago, I think 4 or 5 years ago, then I decided to do it. I also find the similarities between these things, between like meditating or learning more about the more philosophical side of, say, Buddhism, which I'm a Buddhist, and then also ayahuasca, the ayahuasca journeys, and other perhaps like psychedelics aided plants that enable these things. I think the end result is the same, at least for me. It's like how we can live very lightly and how we can always bruise our ego. So I like bruising my ego now. I really like bruising my ego. I find it really fun.
I like living lightly more than bruising my ego, because for me, the ways that I most like bruising my ego, those are easy for me now. And the ways that my ego most needs to be bruised is harder. Like I get my ego bruised in my core partnership and I hate it. I know it's good for me. I can feel myself like working that edge. I'm working my edge. I'm growing.
You notice it, right? You notice that with your reactions. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I'm super reactive. So what I'm working on right now is that I just take things personally, and that's something that I can't work on my own because it's an interpersonal challenge. So if I'm meditating, meditation does help, but for me, this thing about the bruising ego makes me think about just like, when I'm dealing with people, I have this ego, and then they say something and I'm like, huh, what does this mean? And so it's interesting how I think on our personal growth path, little things pop up that we need most when we need them. So it sounds like for you, you started Wonderfruit, and then that was a huge challenge. And I've attended Wonderfruit, and I know somewhat about your journey with it. It's an enormous challenge what you've done, and to have this long sustainability roadmap that unfolds over time, and to iterate and to have challenge that you have to iterate on. Those are some major challenges. So that's a lot of ego bruising along the way. Would you say that's accurate?
Yes, completely. Completely. It's taught me a lot, to say the least.
Why did you first, when you were first thinking of creating something, as I understand it, so you had a legacy of environmentalism from your father, from the Think Earth campaign. Can you tell us a little bit about your background in environmentalism and how you came up with the idea to use a festival to achieve these environmental goals?
Sure. So my dad created this environmental campaign called Think Earth. This was 1980, I think, if I'm not mistaken, like around 1989 or something.
Actually, so, once, can you locate us a little bit with your family too? Because you come from a pretty prestigious family in Thailand. Mm-hmm. So maybe if you can kind of like locate the wave of what your family's done in Thailand and how the environmentalism came out from there.
Sure. So my grandfather, his parents immigrated from China. So my grandfather was self-taught. You know, he came dirt poor, didn't have a dime to his name. He started working in dealing with like parts, spare parts in Chinatown in Bangkok. He was self-taught. He didn't go to school. But he built his reputation built upon like trust and being very, very hardworking, very diligent. Somehow he was able to get on a boat, like an old boat to Japan, and then make his way over there and convince you know, some Japanese automotive brands. Actually, we started out with a brand called Nissan. Back then, it was Datsun. And back then, you know, none of the Japanese automotive brands were exposed outside of Japan. Japan was still very much an island. And it was an economic superpower of its own, but no one knew it was an island. And frankly, their products, they just started making them. You know, like back then, it was still very, very new. So he went by boat. He was able to convince you know, some Japanese partners there that Thailand would be a good partner, you know, would be a good place to send over some cars. So the first car that to ship out of Japan was actually because of my grandfather.
And the first of across the entire world, the first Japanese car.
Yeah, the first
out of
Japanese
Japan.
Car. Yeah.
Wow.
It was a Datsun, a Nissan.
A lot of cars have followed that initial car. Yeah. I have owned a Japanese car in my life. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So he started out with that, and you know, through you know, he has like three words that he likes to highlight, which are like kind of like the core of our family. It's ability, integrity, and diligence. So. With these three words, he built an empire, and he had my father, who was the seventh child, became CEO of that empire, and he's always, my grandfather, I think, always taught his children that with success comes great responsibility, and with great responsibility also means social responsibility. So in my father's time. My father actually moved us to Vancouver when we were very young. For some reason, he's always had a love of the outdoors, my father, although he's not like a very active outdoors man, but he just loves, you know, the environment. And
what is your dad's name?
My dad's name is Pornthep. Pornthep, yeah. And I think living in Vancouver had a huge effect, frankly, on that, because I don't know if you've been to Vancouver.
I have, yeah. I went to a festival called Base Coast outside of Vancouver. Great festival.
Yeah, but it's probably, you know, Vancouver is probably one of the most beautiful cities, I think, in the world, right? With the mountains and the ocean and, you know, everything in between. So I think that rubbed off on him somehow. And when he came back to Thailand, which is around, I think, you know, we came back in like 1987 or something, 1988. So he started Think Earth, which is probably coming to around 30 years now, the anniversary of that. And 30 years ago, as you can imagine, like very few people were talking about global warming. No one was talking about it, at least in Thailand or in Asia, and conservation and, you know, how to use... you know, to create this type of social environmental campaign. So he was a pioneer of that. And you know, he was recognized globally. You know, the UN awarded him awards and all that. So when I was young, I was exposed to that just because I was dragged along to participate in these various activities, such as planting trees or restoring coral reefs. And, you know, a lot of the work was done like very much on the ground, meaning like he would go to these areas and participate in these activities such as like tree planting or, you know, restoring or conservation. And yeah, so I was exposed to that. But what I felt was that, you know, at that time, at least when I was, you know, I was probably like 10 or 12 or something, 11. But I felt like it was quite like tedious. You know, I don't think I enjoyed it very much. But I really recognized the importance of it. So,
it reminds me of meditation a little bit. You know, when you're younger and you think about meditation, you're like, oh, that's super tedious. Why would I do that? That seems like the worst thing you possibly do. And then later on, you rediscover it and see its value.
Yeah, exactly. You see the value of it and you see the joy in it, right? So, that's a great example. And when I went along, I didn't really see any value. You know, I mean, I saw the value. I since I was young, I actually recognized the value of nature and the environment. And I've been, you know, very, I love the outdoors, and I've participated in a lot of like activities outdoors, like sports and all that. So at a very young age, I've been close to the environment, but the concept of Wonderfruit came from that, I thought, okay, how can we apply this to things that I thought were like fun, that people can engage with very, very easily, such as music and art and food and, you know, all like stuff like popular culture that we're so absorbed in that we live daily. So that was how the seed of Wonderfruit was planted.
Well, so you and I talked 2 years ago because I attended Wonderfruit in 2017. And what I remember when we had that conversation was that you were a raver, right? Didn't you rave in the 90s?
Yeah. I was a big time raver. I think I still am. I'm a professional raver now.
You know, we all hope to become professional ravers at some point. You know, and throwing a festival is a good way of becoming a professional raver. So you were a raver, but that's not really what you told me in that conversation. Was that it was Secret Garden Party in the UK that was a little bit after your like 90s era raving days. That's what really inspired you to put the pieces together and say, okay, environmental impact and banging music festival.
Yeah. So the Secret Garden, what clicked to me at Secret Garden was that, wow, you know, people are spending 4 days together in surroundings that are quite beautiful. And therefore, it could be really interesting if we use the time to create some sort of dialogue with people. Before Secret Garden, I had never been to a camping music festival. I've been to festivals and, you know, obviously my raving days, I went to a lot of raves. You know, I went to countless raves, but we didn't really sleep at them. You know, we went to the rave and, you know, we'd go somewhere else and we slept in a hotel or whatever nearby. So that format was interesting to me. And when I came back, I was like, hey, not many people are really doing this in Asia, like a camping type of, you know, where you can actually come and sleep at the event. It also gives you the liberty once you're able to contain people, say for 4 days, you know, it gives that type of time, the liberty of time to program things, right? Whether it's, you know, morning or night or sunrise, sunset, whatever. With that context, I think it becomes really interesting. So then after Secret Garden, then I was like, okay, I need to do a bit more research into these events. And then, so then I went to my first burn in, like 6 years ago, I think 6 years ago. Yeah. And then, I've been, four times or five times since. Yeah. I really enjoy the burn. I love it.
The burn is the best. It's my favorite.
Yeah.
The container that you're describing, this, when it's camping, it takes on its own life. It becomes another world. When you go to the event and then you leave, you're interacting with people who aren't in the same container. So it doesn't become the same kind of stew that it is when you're camping.
Oh, completely. Completely. Yeah. It gives it a whole new dimension. It gives it a whole new meaning, a whole new life. completely.
Well, and I think that I think that's part of why it is a good container to seed these information, because, you know, it's one thing to hear someone talk about sustainability. It's another thing to be in an environment where everyone is using, you know, the same kind of refillable cup for 4 days. You know, it's sort of, you can kind of change behavior, I think. I think that's part of why people find them to be transformational, is because over time, you know, things move through you when you're in that container.
Yeah, and I also would add that by having a camping, or when you actually sleep on site, it takes you out of your normal life a little bit more, right? So you're in the, so automatically you're in the context of a space that you're not very used to, whereas going back to hotels or wherever, you know, you just go back into the rat race. So,
and you know, I think with a camping festival too, it brings the presence of the environment closer to you. You know, you are in a place with grass and trees, and you're in a place where you have to shit somewhere, you have to eat, like, they're all the things. We have such an atomized
you think about it more. Exactly. Yeah,
it's so atomized in a city. You're sort of like, things are kind of like set up to not be seen. You don't really see where things come from or where they go. And so I think that just to let you know, personally, I really like Wonderfruit as an environmental project. And I'd heard about that before I went, and I was like, well, let's see how this plays out, you know, because a lot of festivals want to be green and they take certain initiatives. But I was actually super impressed with Wonderfruit, because it really felt like the environmental awareness was absolutely everywhere. And it was not just everywhere in talks and kind of scolding. It was like in really fun ways. Like, one of the things that I like is the trash monsters. I'm going to paint a picture for the listener. So there are these trash monsters that, it's this sorting system for trash, and they're pieces of art, and they look like Sesame Street characters. They're like big, bushily, weird creatures. And I've seen people ask you to sort your trash, but I've never had to like put different pieces of trash into different monsters' mouths. And I think that's a perfect representation of the particular flavor that I felt like was available in terms of the sustainability of Wonderfruit. And what are some of the creative choices that you've personally made where you were like, yes, nailed it, that's going to really be the way that I share this environmental message through this way? Were there certain things where you're like the trash monsters, for example, what was something where you're like, yes, nailed it?
So, you know, with content, right, we actually, that's how we start. So we start with like, okay, what issue do we want to talk about? And then how are we going to engage audiences with this issue? So, you know, the trash monster was an example, but actually we do that almost with almost everything we do, with all the builds we do, you know, with the architecture, with, you know, with the art pieces, with the food. So I could give you actually countless examples, but let me perhaps give you a couple of my favorites. When you were here in 2017?
Yeah.
Okay, 2017. So you were exposed to perhaps the tree coin initiative that we did.
Yeah, I was going to talk to you about the mangroves and the tree coin. I actually learned about mangrove trees sequestering carbon from that experience. So there you
awesome.
Go. Like, I didn't actually know that mangroves were like the way to do it. So you want to talk about mangroves?
So I the reason I really liked that activation was that, like, so, you know, it was designed on multiple levels, meaning in 2017 there was this huge I think like kind of interest in cryptocurrency that was happening globally, and that's actually the year when the prices went, you know, it peaked at, like, especially Bitcoin, right? People went crazy over it. So then basically, that, you know, the hype was there. For us, how we were using that technology, the blockchain, to really create impact. So that for us, that was like, okay, we see Bitcoin out everywhere, and we try to understand the technology behind it. We were really attracted, and still am, with the technology behind it, which is blockchain. And we're like, how can we integrate that to create impact? So we partnered up with a platform, a Swiss fintech platform, that we're working on this as well. And then we partnered up with them to issue these tree coins, which were basically tokens, tree tokens, that was the value back then was like each tree coin was worth a dollar. So with that, we also then said, okay, how can we create? So that was like the digital virtual representation. And then we were like, okay, how can we create a physical representation of that? So then we engaged in this artist who didn't know anything about blockchain or Bitcoin. But we felt that he had the right methodology, because historically, to work with this type of mechanism. So we engaged with a Thai artist named Wit, and we got him completely into blockchain, into Bitcoin. Like, he became like, he knew more about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies than us. Like, in like 3 weeks, he completely geeked out over it, which is great to see him, you know, get the bug as well. And then, so he came up with a really clever mechanism where he created these like paper dolls that you fold, like kind of like origami, but they were 3D. And these paper dolls were shaped in the form of a tree hugger. So that basically would mimic the mining process of Bitcoin. So like, you know,
so the mining was the folding?
Yeah, the mining was the folding, but as you fold each one, it becomes harder to fold the other, which is the similar process of how crypto are mined. It takes more processing power to get each coin. So then we introduced this thing called Tree Hour, modeled after, say, Happy Hour, and then Tree Hour was like from 5 to 7. So to link the interaction between the audience and these initiatives. So as you can see just now, there are three things, right? The first thing was the using technology to enable impact, which is blockchain. And the second one was the physical representation of the blockchain or the tree coin, right? And then the third one was, okay, how do we get audiences to really engage with this in a very easy way? Which basically, Tree Hour, there's nothing easier than giving out free tree coins during designated hours. So you didn't even need to really work for it. It was seamless, right? Meaning from 5 to 7, if you bought like a certain drink from us, then you would get issued a tree coin. So that back then, you know, this is 3 years ago, but it seems like a long time ago, you would have to go through a certain KYC process to download this app in order to get your tree coin. Which, we had like a couple hundred people do, but I think a lot of people dropped off because the process to download the app, for security reasons, it took a bit, you know, you had to like register, you had to send a photo, whatever. I mean, you know, it's a safety issue.
It wasn't right for a festival.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we had them do it. I think even they could do it right there, but they could also do it after the festival. But for me, I really like that, because I think that's how we like to think of content. It's actually quite complex, but at the same time, we try to make it as easy and as interactive as we can. But also, it's also very cutting edge. But at the same time, it was also physically, you know, very simple and beautiful to see like these tree huggers. And we put these tree huggers on these trees, actually. So they hug the trees after you would fold them. So it was like, you know, both like on a virtual, digital, on a physical, and on an interaction. You know, I think it was completely interactive. The experience was completely interactive. So hopefully we can introduce more of these type of experiences that are seamless, meaning like you know, the human interaction with something that we do at Wonderfruit then triggers something else. And this event, this activation triggers something else. But you would have to perhaps be a little bit interested in what it triggers than to understand the fascination of it. But if not, then you just, you know, then you just perhaps just get, you know, something from it, you know. So you can go deeper if you're interested and fascinated, but if you're not, then, you know, perhaps you just like the way it looks and, you know, something like that. So we like to kind of think of content like that.
Well, and so the outcome of that activation was also that you were planting mangrove groves in Myanmar.
Yeah, yeah. We planted I think we have 20,000 trees planted, right? Yeah, 20,000.
What I learned, and this is the interesting awareness piece, is that I went to the talk by the old Swiss dude. Was he Swiss or the old Nordic dude who talked about this? I think his name might have been Thor, or maybe I think all Swiss people's names are Thor.
Yeah.
But I went to his talk and I learned about mangroves and about how they protect against soil erosion, which is a huge thing in tourist destinations because there's so much soil erosions because people want these pristine beaches, but then the ocean eats the beach away, but you got to plant these mangrove trees. And so for me, it was really interesting because, you know, I contributed to get this coin, I supported these trees, I learned about these trees. The one thing I didn't get about that activation was it doesn't really function in terms of a currency in the sense that I then am going to spend my tree coin somewhere else.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
I think it was more like
it was ahead of its time because that was one of the shortcomings that happened was that I guess like we tried to position it that the tree coin was worth you know was hedged against say the US currency or the euro, but I think like that's where perhaps we got a bit of the messaging wrong. I think people should have invested in the tree coin just for the sake of protecting the environment and not perhaps because we kind of seeded the idea that, oh, you would be able to convert your coin into something, which, you know, we shouldn't have seeded that idea. We should have just seeded it that it was just a token and, you know, you keep it, you have a tree planted on your behalf. And then if there is some way that we can then convert that token into something else that you can trade or, you know, that you could convert into something else within our network, then I think that would have been probably the better way to do it. But back then, I mean, you know, it was like all this stuff was quite new. It still is very new, you know, these digital tokens. So we were playing around as well.
Well, you know, and this actually circles back really well to the efficacy of using a festival format for this kind of experiment and iteration, because that's 2017. You did the tree coin. It worked in certain ways. It was interactive. It was fun. People learned things. It didn't actually play out as a token, but that's fine. And then you can go back and you can try something new. I actually wanted to ask you about something because I was listening in preparing for this interview. I was listening to a recent podcast you did on. So Wonderfruit has a podcast, which is called Wondercast. Is that what you've called?
Wondercast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you alluded on an episode I listened to, you alluded to an empathy experiment where, and I'll just tee you up so you can explain this. So basically what I was listening to is what you were saying is that really a lot of environmentalism comes down to empathy. So in that year at the festival, I think this was last year, you wanted an experiment in seeding empathy. And on the podcast, you kind of alluded to the fact that it did not work. That the project that you tried was a worthy experiment, but it didn't work. But you didn't tell the story about how it didn't work, and it seemed like it might be like what was this empathy experiment you tried, and why didn't it work?
So, okay, yeah, I don't remember if I said it worked or not, but in hindsight,
I got the impression it did not work on the podcast I was listening to. I got the impression you're not going to try doing it again.
The experiment itself was very bold, I think, looking back at it now, to do just because it required perhaps more infrastructure and logistic synchronization than we imagined. But we in the end we did manage to pull it off. But it just took a bit longer. The time took a bit longer, which I think threw it off. So basically, just to give the audience a bit of insight into what we tried to do, or what we actually did, was we wanted to see if we can engineer empathy. And we did this in collaboration with like an underground a theater group in the UK called highly experimental, called the Word Off Project. So, and he's only done this to like groups of like 10 people. So like when I first got introduced to him, and we were kicking around ideas, and we were like, shit, like, can we do this to the whole festival? And that's like, what, 10,000 or whatever. And then we're like, yeah, we can. And then we're like, what's the largest audience you did it to? He's like, oh, I've only done this to 10 people. We're like, okay, let's see if we could pull this off. But you know, the concept was that we would, for a brief moment, we would unite everyone at the festival, right? And meaning unite, meaning that we would bring everyone together in the same area. And as those of you that have been to Wonderfruit, you can see that, you know, we operate on a very big piece of land, and we have so many stages, and everything's going on all at the same time. So to have everyone be at one place, or one, say, stage or one area at all at the same time, you know, is probably next to impossible to do. So, but in order to facilitate that, what we did was we shut everything off at all the other stages, you know, all the light, all the sound, everything. And then we tried to herd people to come to one area. It's like herding cats.
That's where you started going wrong, man. Yeah, trying to herd a bunch of festival kids.
Yeah, festival. This is Sunday at like 9 p.m. This is like coming towards the end. Everyone's super hyped. So then... But we actually managed to pull it off, because we did a lot of communication before the event that, look, we're going to do this experiment, please participate. And then we got everyone together. We had everyone, we drew a grid on the ground, you know, which was like very calculated, the grid. So even the process of herding people, you know, the Word Off Project, they went into great lengths. They even used some form of AI to calculate footprint, how you can herd people, you know, how you can fence them, bring them together, and then what the amount of time it would take. And then we drew this type of white grid on the ground. So everyone was laid on the ground, and we had these beautiful synchronized dancers come out with synchronized outfits that sensory lights. It was really beautiful, and very, you know, it was almost like you'd come to, like, you know, to you had come to meet to like some sort of ritual, or, you know, that was quite, it was minimal, but like done in a very, you know, it was beautiful to see, actually, these dancers. And then these dancers would then guided people, put everyone on the ground, and then put overlapped each other's hand on another. So you would basically form a huge human grid. And at the same time, we had this artist called Not Waving, which does beautiful type of very powerful soundtracks that actually have a lot of science backed up by it, that how it relates to empathy, and how it creates to create emotion. You know, sound and emotion are very much linked. So all that together, you know, we try to put all that together. And the goal was to try to do that within, like, I think like 15 minutes, but it took us 40 minutes to herd everyone, to put them on the ground, to have these dancers come out. The music went on to sync it. It was still very beautiful. And actually a lot of people were very emotional. We had a lot of people cry. And it was like, either you loved it, you hated it, or you didn't understand what it was. But we had actually a lot of people love it. A lot of people still this day was like, wow, that was really powerful. A lot of people were like, oh, fuck, that was a waste of time. I was, you know, whatever. And then a lot of people were just scratching their head like, oh, I didn't quite get that. But I think the point was that, you know, what we were trying to actually communicate was that, look, empathy comes in many forms. Right, it doesn't just come from like lying on the ground listening to a beautiful piece of music, you know, while being formed in a human grid. Although that could be one form, but it also comes from the understanding of that and what we are trying to attempt. And even for us, empathy came for us as like, oh, sometimes you can't really force people to do stuff. So I think, I mean, looking at it in hindsight and giving it time, it made more sense. But right after the event, you know, we had a lot of mixed responses to that. I mean, you know, some people from my team were like, hey, we need to take down, because we were getting a lot of backlash from social. We're like, hey, we need to take down these posts. And but then I made the decision that to say no. You know, we just look, you're going to have two sides of the coin. And then every experiment we do, I think it's sometimes good to be slightly, what do you call it? Like, you can't please everyone. And that's what we recognize. And we're not here to please everyone. So we will continue to experiment just as long as we feel that the greater message is one that is not harmful to anyone. I think that's important. We did not harm anyone, right? So we annoyed at people. But, I mean, music can annoy people. Anything can annoy people, right? So anyways, I really like that one as well. I like that experiment. And I think it brought the team together really well, because it was such a high level of synchronization to be able to do that, to attempt that, production-wise, marketing-wise, on-the-ground-wise. Everything had to be synced to accomplish that. So.
Okay, so I want to do kind of a rapid fire thing here, because I think a lot of people who are listening to this podcast are going to want to know, why is Wonderfruit this paradigm of sustainability? What is it you're on the ground doing? And for me, before I came to the festival, I was like, yeah, it's going to probably have some recycling and that sort of thing. But I was impressed that there's a lot going on. So in the spirit of talking about experiments, could you please for me throw out some of the experiments in environmental sustainability that you've explored at the festival, and perhaps just on a scale of 1 to 10, or however you want to frame it, how well they landed. So, for example, you know, you made the farm stage was made entirely out of bamboo and rice. That's an experiment. Let me know how it went. And if you could just give me like the rapid fire, like a handful of things that you've done on the festival grounds.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, we built a stage out of trash. That was year one. That was quite simple. You know, we collected trash from around the area. We built it more elaborately. Yeah, the rice stage was more elaborate because we actually grown grass. We had to grow rice on the land, and we used the rice. We cultivated the rice, and we built a stage out of rice. And that was something I think was really impactful, because culturally it meant a lot. Basically meaning in the northeastern region of Thailand, you used to have these elaborate ceremonies called Prasad Kha, which translates to rice castle, which is actually exactly what we built, except we built it on a 37-meter scale. Back then, they used to build it on a very small scale as like a shrine. And the reason they built that was that it was used to give blessings for a fruitful season, meaning bring a lot of rain. So as you can see now, if you go to the Northeast, you don't see this anymore, just because
that's
of
like
mass.
Chiang Mai? That's like where Chiang Mai is?
Yeah, around the Isan area, more of the Isan area. But you don't see that because of mass industrialization farming. So there's no use. There's no reason for people to do these ceremonies to call blessings, because, you know, it's all pesticides and fertilizers anyway. So it's, you know, so farming, agriculture has changed tremendously. So we were trying to provoke that with the rice stage. And as a stage, it was beautiful. It was completely beautiful. And then after that, the rice, you know, we gave the rice away, and people milled the rice and they ate it. So it was a very sustainable stage. We built a farm on site as well. And the farm, we planted herbs and plants that could use for remedies. So everything from like, say, a hangover to a headache to an insect bite. And again, that has a very strong message behind that of how nature is our most powerful ally. And, you know, nowadays you have kids that are more afraid of, a lot of people are afraid of, you know, eating plants, digesting plants, or rubbing it on their body, but they're not afraid of walking to a 7-Eleven and buying, you know, whatever's on the counter and rubbing it all over their face, which is really weird to me, right? That's like, so everything we do, actually, we're trying to provoke something. Whether people get it or not, I mean, yeah, you know, I think some people get it, some people don't. But actually, I could go on, the list can go on, because everything we do actually has something to do with, you know, or ethos.
You know, I want to talk about the farm, because one of the things I liked is that that farm experience wasn't just about the environment there. That was also community too. That was, you had that group, the Thailand Young Farmers, who were, yep, who were working with that and then selling these remedies and speaking about them. And I think that's one of the things that's really meaningful in the context of this conversation about environmentalism is like, it's, we're all seeking community. We want to be connected with each other. We want to feel like we're part of a groovy artistic crew. And I really liked that part of the festival. And I liked the fact that these folks who are producing these remedies, who are producing this food, they're actually in community with each other, which I think was a huge value as well for the festival.
Yes, completely. The community part's a really big part, and understanding culture and community in terms of the environmental context. So that even has been like a really big lesson for me, and I still continue to stay to learn more about this, because like when you think of these environmental issues, right, in every country, a lot of like on the surface, it may seem like I give you one example, which is up north, we have a big problem with, say, communities burning forests, and everyone's like, oh, how can they burn these forests, right? And it looks really bad, like from the outside. But when you actually actually study the problem deeper, it goes into a community level, meaning like, you know, crop rotation or reforestation back then was very normal. This is what they did, right? And to supplement their livelihood. So without understanding the community aspect, there's no way you can understand culturally how that relates and environmentally how that relates. So I guess the first, you know, so that's how like we also you know, have to educate ourselves, and the education comes from not only reading, I think, but also being talking and being exposed to people directly on the ground. So that's things that we learn along the way that is quite interesting for us.
One of the things that I really appreciated about the festival was how much it was a Thai festival, and how many different aspects of Thai culture were expressed, especially like Thai folk music. There was this like beautiful bus stage where there was this incredible Thai folk music. Obviously the food, Thai food is known around the world, but the food at the festival was incredible. There were like ladyboy performers as like one aspect of Thai culture. So this kind of like this championing of Thai culture and local Thai bands was a really interesting aspect of the festival that I really appreciated. You know, it was a little tricky though, because you have these like some of these expats at the festival and you have some Thai people at the festival, and it's hard to get those groups to fully interact with each other and fully engage with each other. And I felt like it was, there was so much more presence at that at Wonderfruit in terms of this cultural representation, but it was still kind of hard to weave in these different communities. How have you explored that over time with the event?
You mean the weaving of the external communities, or is that?
Yeah,
the
question? Yeah. I mean, I think that people have a tendency to kind of often stick in their own sort of communities, and obviously, if people are speaking Thai, then it's harder to like connect in some ways. But how have you seen the integration of, you know, travelers and expat communities with the local Thai at the festival?
So okay, yeah, that's an interesting observation. As you know, Wonderfruit is very very diverse. The demographic is actually represented. I mean, diverse meaning also from a visual point of view, because you can see very very clearly that there's as many perhaps Asians as there are Western Caucasians. So, but with that meaning, how do we integrate them, right? So, I mean, I guess that's something that, you know, it's still a challenge, meaning like if you talk about the integration of content, that's very, very easy for us to do, because that's, you know, that's just how we create the programming, right? I would say now it's leaning more towards Thai and regional content, except for the music. We still get a lot of music from, say, Europe or from America. But still, if you look at our complete lineup, you know, I would say we have more probably coming from this part of the world now than from the West. And that integration, I think, is quite easy to do, right? But
I noticed that as well. And I especially liked the integration of Thai music. And particularly, there's a style of Thai folk music that...
Ma Lam, right?
What is it?
Ma Lam, Thai Ma Lam.
Yeah. And it was kind of like from poor, like farmer regions, but now it's like super hip in part because of Wonderfruit. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. That stage, the bus stage is, it's great. It's, before that, not many people, even Thai people, more privileged people, they associated Ma Lam with like being perhaps like almost peasant music. And now you can see them like dancing away to it at Wonderfruit or at other venues in Bangkok or Thailand as well, which is great. But the integration of that type of content is, for us, it's really important to be able to, you know, be well represented and also culturally, locally, to be able to present this type of context in a interesting way. But you can see like with the crowd, of course, there's cliques of people, right? Like people that come together or, you know, say Western or versus say Thai groups, and they tend to perhaps click onto each other. I think that's an area that we need to work on more. Like, for example, the talks part, it's still very much heavily attended by more internationals than locals. So that's something that this year we've been conscious of, and how can we involve more local speakers and how can we get more locals to attend the talks, right? So hopefully this year we'll see more of that integration, because I think that leads to people being more friendly, or you know, more exposed to each other is when they're in arena together, asking questions together, seeking answers together, and then that way it kind of breaks the ice more. So.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's a huge compliment to the festival that it is so integrated content-wise, because I absolutely noticed that. And for me as a traveler, it's my first time in Thailand. I got to experience so much at the festival that I have not experienced at other festivals with a lot of international attendees. But that question of how do you integrate these different groups, and is it really what people want? You know, is it what the local Thai want? But at the same time, if you have these two groups and they're not very integrated, you're kind of running sort of parallel communities. So it's just kind of an interesting issue, I think, with areas with strong expat communities like Thailand. You know, there's a lot of digital nomads love Chiang Mai. You know, I met a group of people who were throwing a festival in Chiang Mai called Jai Tep. And a lot of those folks are burners from the US that came to create this festival, or Quest Festival in Vietnam. It's also kind of thrown by some Westerners. I think the fact that you are Thai and that your co-founder is also Thai.
Mon Ton Jira, yeah.
Yeah. I think the fact that I've really gotten from the conversations we've had and from the festival itself, a deep love of Thailand and showcasing Thai art and culture, and also supporting Thailand as a country environmentally. And I think that really runs through the festival for me. And that's something I really took away and really enjoyed and appreciated. So thank you for that.
No, thank you. Thank you for your kind words.
Okay, so I have one thing about Wonderfruit that is, for me, the most challenging around the environmentalism, and it's most challenging for me. I love to go to awesome places, and I go to them on planes. Mm. And when I went to Thailand, I was a speaker at Wonderfruit, and I flew on a plane, and my other colleagues that were Western speakers came in on planes. And so I think that when we're talking about environmentalism, destination festivals are, you know, that's a lot of carbon emission to get people there. And I think it's one of the biggest issues, even for a local festival with so many cars going out and diesel generators and that sort of thing. I know that you have been carbon neutral at the festival, but how do you do carbon offsetting for travel? Like, how do you balance, for an environmental project like Wonderfruit, how do you balance all this travel?
So this year we've introduced a carbon calculator. We built it in on our ticketing platform, on our website. So anyone now actually has the opportunity to be able to offset their carbon. They just type in, you know, where they're flying in from, what class they're flying in, if they're flying by plane, and then it calculates. And actually, the cost to offset carbon, even like say like a flight from say New York first class, I think we calculated it like 4,000 baht. So that's first class. So if you're flying economy, it's like 120 baht. Yeah, something like that, 200. So that's like a couple dollars, $3-4, right? Not very much.
Do you know how carbon offsetting works? Because what does it mean? Like, if it costs that much to offset it, what are you doing? You're buying carbon from elsewhere. Does it work?
So this year we're collaborating with a very reputable Thai organization. They're an NGO called Ma Fa Luang. So it was actually under the patronage of the royal family. So it's, you know, it's taken very, very seriously, and they actually do amazing work, which deals with reforestation. So for us, the reason we were attracted to Doi Tung or Ma Fa Luang was that their work involves community as well. So it's not just about planting trees, because, you know, you can plant a tree, but who's taking care of the tree, and how does the tree or the ecology of that relate to the community? Right. So again, it goes back to that like a tree or forest burning example I gave just now. But so this project, Doi Tung, they work very much up north with the local communities. And they also work about how these communities can understand the importance of living very closely with nature and vice versa, and how nature also depends on humans. So the way it's offset it is that the tree, the way it sequesters carbon is like as it grows, right, it sequesters more carbon, but then it hits its like peak at like, depending on the type of tree, I think some trees could hit its peak at like, I don't know, 20 years or 30 years and or whatever. And then that's when sometimes you have to plant more trees, right? So, but that's why I think the human element of it is really, really important to recognize that as well. For the first time, we're going to offer that to Wonderfruit attendees. But I think for us, it's like, I think just to have people be conscious of their travel. I mean, I like you and probably everyone that attends Wonderfruit, everyone loves to travel. And I think like we've just started hitting we've just scratched the surface of because traveling is such much more easier now. You know, with like so many options of connecting flights and airlines, and you know, we've just hit the surface of traveling, you know, or Earth, and we can see that our planet is becoming much smaller as a result because people are just going everywhere so easily now. So, and I actually think there's a huge benefit to traveling to see new things and absorb new cultures. So we're, you know, but at the same time, obviously it comes at a cost, and to be, I think, mindful of that cost is just what we're trying to say. It's just to be like, that calculator is just built in to be like, oh wow, that's an interesting thing. Every time you get on a plane and you fly somewhere, you know, there's a huge cost to it environmentally. But at the same time, you can neutralize that cost by helping with, you know, these projects. And there's multiple projects globally, I think, that are certified. But I think you have to, that's why people need to study a bit these projects, because I think a lot of them are perhaps like just greenwashing projects, and, you know, with perhaps there's no sustainability initiative in mind, meaning like how sustainable is just planting trees, right? I mean, compared to like, you know, like the projects that we usually try to get involved in are very, very certified on multiple levels, you know, not only by like, you know, UN or other, but, you know, on there's a lot of reputable certification organizations now that certify, because a lot of people are trying to take advantage of the situation as well. So I would just encourage people to do a bit of study into these things.
So, you know, this is inspiring for me. A lot of times if I do a podcast like this, it's not just that I'm, you know, I want my audience to learn, but I want to learn too. And I feel like one of the ways that I am out of integrity in my life is that I don't carbon offset my flight. I travel a lot. I've had an enormous privilege to go to really cool places. And I feel like this would be a good time for me to get more serious about that. So here's what I'm going to do. After we finish this podcast, I'm going to do a little research myself and find some resources that I can point the audience to start looking at some carbon offsets for their own travel, because it's something that I've been meaning to do for a while and I keep putting it off. I'm like, oh, I should look into that. And I think that it's really... if we want to have these lavish festival lifestyles, now of course, there's a lot of privilege that allows us to do that, but let's take that aside for the moment and just look at the cost environmentally. If we want to have these incredible lifestyles, we can't, like you've just said, we have to be conscious of what the cost is on the environment. And so I would like to use this as an opportunity for myself to start taking carbon offsetting my own flights more seriously. And I'd like to invite the audience to as well. And we have a Facebook group for Life is a Festival. And so just to, you know, put my money where my mouth is, I will, in that Facebook group, I will let everybody know what I'm doing with my carbon offsets. And I'll put some stuff in the intro to this and also in the show notes about some resources to look for. Because I feel like, you know, it feels good to talk about environmental stuff, but one of the things I like about you is that you're really doing tangible stuff and you're iterating and it's really present for you. And I'd like it to be more present for me. So thank you for that. And I'm
that's
gonna
awesome
do
to
it.
Hear.
Yeah,
that's awesome to hear. Yeah, these small things really make a big difference, I think. The collective impact, I think that's what another thing that I've really recognized is, like, these little small actions, they add up because, like, it resonates with other people. And then, you know, before you know it, everyone's kind of like, you know, becomes cool and trendy to do these things, and then everyone's doing it, which is great. So,
and that is what I feel like Wonderfruit is. Wonderfruit is making sustainability sexy. Wonderfruit is like, it's like, hey, this is the cool place that people are going. And at the cool place that they're going, they're not using single-use plastic. And they're, you know, in other ways too, they're taking care of their bodies. There's meditation, there's yoga, that sort of thing. But in the environmental space, like, the hip thing is to have a reusable, I got this, right? And, you know, we're having... this is actually, I'm drinking from a reusable water bottle from Earth Day San Francisco 2013. But, you know, like...
See how long that's lasted, right? Yeah.
Totally. Amazing. Totally. And when I went to Wonderfruit, you know what you guys had that I really appreciated is you had the cool little cup holder that attached to your belt that kind of like, It was a lot easier to have the reusable cup with you. I still have that. It has Wonderfruit written on it. So it's kind of nice branding too.
Yeah, so you know what we're doing this year? We're introducing all reusable cups. So we're not going to have any disposable cups at all this year, which I think will be a huge step in reducing waste that we've set out to do. So our goal this year is to have like zero landfills as well. So everything that we consume and on site that hopefully we can control will either be recycled, composted, or reused. So meaning hopefully nothing will go into landfills. That's our target.
So Wonderfruit is this incredible environmental project, and it's teaching attendees to take sustainability more seriously and to make it more sexy and fun and cool to do it. How do you measure the ripple effects of that? How do you know that when someone goes to Wonderfruit that they're going to be potentially making a change in their life? Like, is it just 4 days of showing off how trendy and green we are, and then we go back to not behaving that way? Like, how does this scale out of the festival?
It's hard to measure. Meaning, we can measure our impact very, very easily, right? And at the festival. But beyond the festival, if you ask from an attendee point of view, do we know if what we've, you know, if they've come to Wonderfruit, has that moved the needle for them? It's really hard to tell. I mean, I frankly, I think, you know, we would be it would be premature for us to say yes that you know we've converted people, everyone's now more, you know, environmentally sensitive or whatever. But I think if you look at the world we are now, and I think these are dialogues that, you know, not only Wonderfruit, but everyone is having this dialogue, right? About like, okay, you know, this is the environmental crisis that we're going through. So I think we're just one, I believe in a lot in the collective impact, and that, you know, we are just one part of, like, say, other initiatives that are going on globally and or locally or whatever. So the more people that do it, right, and show that these things can be done without sacrificing, because a lot of people think that, oh, in order to do things like this, you have to sacrifice something. You have to perhaps settle for inferior quality. You have to settle for inconvenience. But actually, a lot of the times, it's actually easier to do. And also, it opens the creativity, I think, much more, you know, when you can use it to solve problems. So I'm not sure how the answer to that question is like, do we really know that people are being influenced? But what we can see, I think, at least in Thailand, is that with Wonderfruit, I think we're kind of seen in the light of like, oh, creative sustainability, whatever Wonderfruit does creatively, people are looking at us. You know, therefore we have a huge responsibility on our shoulders. Even people who don't come to Wonderfruit, they're looking at us. So hopefully with this type of message and what we do and taking these things that we do seriously, then people can, you know, perhaps be interested in these things, and then they could do the, you know, their own version of what we're doing, or do even more than what we're doing. So that's all I think. I think that's the most that we can hope for, is we do the best that we can, and therefore the best that we can, meaning, you know, there's a lot of very basic stuff that we need to do even better, right? Simple stuff, such as even trash management and energy consumption. So that's why we're paying attention a lot to that. And hopefully with what we do, to the best of how we can do it, that will resonate. And again, I think it's going to that spiritual, holistic level, that, you know, the ongoing journey to be the best version of yourself. So Wonderfruit is on the same journey, but it involves obviously multiple stakeholders and multiple people, but we want to be the best version of what we can. So, and hopefully that will resonate. I think once you're the best version of what you can, once you can kill your ego and being not selfish in that, then I think then people will see the benefit of that. So we're hoping that that's what people will see.
So what does your dad think of all this? He had this environmental campaign. He's passionate about the outdoors. And you, his son, have this legacy piece of Wonderfruit. What does he think about it? What does he tell you about his perspective on Wonderfruit?
Well, in the first year, I remember he attended Wonderfruit in the first year. And I was walking with him, and he tapped me on the shoulder, and he's like, so... And he said in a very, you know, he wasn't giving me any praise, but he was saying it in like a very matter of fact type of way. He said, so this is what you've been spending your time doing. This looks like a Woodstock, you know. And he didn't mean that as a compliment, but I took it as a great compliment. I was like, wow, Woodstock. I mean, Woodstock, you know, as you know, it was used to protest the war, right? And actually to great effect. I think it shifted a lot of American public sentiment back then. It was hugely successful in doing what it did. So, but yeah, he didn't mean it as a compliment. So, anyways, but fast forward now to last year. You know, last year he came again. He comes every year for a couple hours, and you can see now that he really likes walking around. And you know, he even brings guests now or friends, and he sits down at, you know, we have like a feasting hall, and you know, and he actually enjoys his dinner. Whereas the first year, you could tell he was like, being a dad, he's always worried, right? And that's you know, and I've, you know, and now I, you know, having kids of my own, I can understand why you know, you're worried. But his body language and his he doesn't really say much, my dad, to compliment, you know, that's kind of how we've been raised. We don't give each other lots of compliments, but I can see it in his body language and just the fact that he comes and invites guests, that he, you know, I think he approves of it somehow. And actually he hears a lot of it from other people. That's what I think is important. So I don't really tell him a lot. Like, even frankly, I was like, I was on this interview like a couple weeks ago, like a Thai popular TV show. And my mom found out about it like later, like because her friend sent it to her or something. And she's like, why don't you tell me about you're on this interview? I was just like, yeah, I prefer for them to find out like from other people the good things. We don't tell them. I don't tell them much either about, I've told you in this hour more than I've told them about or environmental initiatives. So you now know more than they do.
Well, maybe they'll listen to this podcast.
I'm going to send them a link.
Yeah, send them a link. Yeah, is that a Thai thing too? Is that common in Thai culture, this kind of dynamic?
I think it's specific, meaning like it's perhaps every household might be slightly different, but I do think it's slightly Thai to be maybe a little bit humble about these things. Yeah. I would like to hope so.
And how does that kind of relate to, so you have three kids, yeah?
Three, yeah.
And do you give a lot of compliments?
When they're young, yes. Yeah, I think at this age they'll forget my compliments. when they start developing an opinion of their own, then I might not give them any compliments.
When they try to make their own music festivals, like, you back in my day, we had to save the environment and have a music festival at the same time. So Wonderfruit is coming up in December. And this is the sixth year.
Mm-hmm.
This is the sixth year of Wonderfruit in December. And you've mentioned some of the things that you're going to be trying, some new things that you're trying this year. But just in the sense of like, if someone's listening to this podcast and they're enjoying the environmental stuff, they're enjoying learning some stuff about you, what should people be excited about who want to come to Thailand and want to come to Wonderfruit? Pitch my audience about your magical festival.
Well, so... Okay, so year six, for everything we do each year kind of evolves, right? So the content is probably 90%, 95% new. We're not doing a main stage anymore. You know, we used to have a main stage, like a big stage. And so we're not doing that anymore. Instead of that, we're creating a new village. So basically, Wonderfruit has become a cluster of villages, all round villages, and they're all linked. That. Yeah, so that's the new village is actually really, really cool. We've sculpted into the ground. We've used the earth around us, and we've built a series of like hills and mounds that are really quite that are shaped very playfully in the form of a nose, an ear, and a mouth. Sorry, fingers, ear, and mouth. Yeah. So that's going to be really, really fun, and that's like super interactive, that whole village. And you know, with that, we actually asked ourselves like, okay, how are we going to really reinvent like how people view performances? How are we going to reinvent the concept of a stage? And I think with that, you know, we this is kind of like understanding of like how if we reinvented a stage, this is kind of what it's gonna be. So it's very interactive, it's very playful. It doesn't even the stage itself doesn't really conform to like stages, meaning the way the light is integrated, or you know, it doesn't have the typical like light on top of it and all that. So I think that's going to be really, really cool. We've extended our time a bit, so meaning gates open Thursday at noon. Last year they opened at 4, and then gates close Monday at 3. So you actually, essentially, you get 12 more hours. So it's like 99 hours now. I think that we counted 99 hours for Wonderfruit nonstop. We've did a design competition, which we're really pleased with the results, and the winners of the design competition are coming from Switzerland. We had a lot of people submit to it, which was really cool for us. And they're going to build, it's called Super Green, Super Lean, Super Clean. So we're trying to build like the greenest, cleanest, leanest pavilion that we can imagine. The panel of judges is represented globally. We have some really distinguished judges. So that was really fun. And now, you know, they're going to come next week to start building that. We're going to house our sustainability initiatives in that pavilion so people can come learn about our journey. What else? We've the solar stage, beloved solar stage, we're reconfiguring again for like the fourth time. It's going to be slightly bigger. The programming on it is I think the programming on solar stage is, you know, always something people look forward to, so that's going to be good. We upgraded a lot of the sound systems. The environmental impact part, we've gone through we've picked every stone and turned it around and to see how we could improve these things. The cup thing, if you think of this, right, the cup, like Burning Man, the thing that, like, I think with Burning Man that is most, that leaves the most impact is the fact that, you know, you have to go with everything, right, by yourself. And therefore, the decisions that you have to shape are very informed by that. So therefore, we took a page out of that book with this refill cup thing, meaning you can bring your own cup or you can buy a cup off us, but we don't have any disposable cups. So therefore, you can't lose your cup. And having people start to be exposed to that mindset, because we live in a very disposable economy. I think everywhere in the world, right? We live in such a disposable type of economy where, you know, so having people shift to that mindset, I think will be really, really interesting, because you can no longer lose your cup or else you have to buy a new one and they're quite expensive and to hold on to your cup. So that's going to be really interesting. But and other areas of the environmental where we've improved is, like I said, we set out a zero landfill initiative this year. We set up like a trash lab on site where we've gone as far as even using, like, you know, we have these coconut trees on site and we have these palm trees, and then every now and then the coconut obviously falls to the ground and, you know, and the leaves, they need trimming or else they get too heavy. And so we've gone to the point of even reusing all that. We've collected all that and we're building structures out of that. So we're having a lot of fun, man. for me, this part, all this stuff is actually very fun. And actually, I hope my enthusiasm has come across, because I think sustainability can be really fun. It really is. Like, you know, it's all, everything is content. And how can you, instead of treating content just like, oh, like content, like how it is now on social media, right? There's just too much content. But if everyone just treated content, that content can be meaningful, and every content can be meaningful, then I think it gives it a whole new life. So that's what we've been up to.
Well, I love your joy. And I think the through line through this whole conversation is that these sustainability initiatives are fun, they're playful, they're cool, they're iterative, they're replicable. You know, there's ways that you can take these lessons back into your life. And to me, I think that's really a remarkable thing. And we're talking about making life like a festival. I mean, the podcast is like, how do we make our lives more like these awesome environments that we're in? And I feel like when I went to Wonderfruit, I learned a little bit more about how to make my life more sustainable and how to be more mindful in terms of my relationship with the environment, and even in this conversation. So I am, after our conversation today, I am going to research and I am committed to offsetting my flying from this conversation.
Awesome.
Because, you know, because we got to, you know, we have to like take that leap. And from what I've read, you know, in a no meat diet, which, you know, I've done at times, but I'm not there right now. And the way that we fly are of the most significant impact in terms of what we're individually contributing to the environment here. And so I feel very inspired. I'm inspired by what you're doing. And more than anything, I'm inspired by your playfulness and your joy. Because, you know, at the very beginning of the conversation, you were talking about the favorite record, because that sparks that joy and that playfulness. And you're not going to get anybody on your initiative to try to save the world with you if you're haggard and angry and grumpy and nothing is any fun. You know, it's just not the way we are. We're social beings, and we need to evolve at play. And maybe, you know, we got to evolve really, really quick because of where the environment is right now, but we still have to bring play into it.
Completely. I attest to that completely.
Well, I feel like that's a good 90 minutes of conversation we've shared today, and I really appreciate you taking
fast.
The time.
I mean, I enjoyed the conversation thoroughly. So time flies when we're having fun. I really enjoyed speaking to you. I've learned a lot as well.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a real pleasure. And I have one more question, but first we say goodbye because the final question happens after the interview. So it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for being on my show.
Thanks, Eamon. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us on Life is a Festival. If you enjoyed this episode, you can support it by sharing it with your friends and leaving a review on iTunes, letting us know what you thought. If you'd like to keep up with me, you can visit my website, EamonArmstrong.com. That's E-A-M-O-N Armstrong.com, or Eamon Armstrong on your favorite social platforms. Thanks for tuning in. Together, we can make life a festival for everyone. See you on the dance floor. Now, the show's over, and I ask you the last question, which is, how'd the podcast go?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, like, you know, you just reminded me we had 90 minutes left. We had, the 90 minutes was up. So I think that was a good sign of, like, of proper engagement. Hope the audience has enjoyed as well.
Did you feel that it was conversational in the way that you were hoping in the beginning?
Completely. Yeah, I felt that too. Yeah. It was very natural. It was very natural.
Is there anything that you wanted to cover or bring up, or anything that you just wanted to express on the podcast that we didn't get to?
Let's see. Actually, you know, I think you've touched upon. You know, and you've been very kind with your words as well. So I really appreciate that.
I'm not your dad. I compliment you hard.
I really appreciate that. Yeah, really appreciate that. And I think we covered good ground. Yeah. I mean, is there anything else? What do you think? Do you think there's anything we're missing?
You know, I think that you can always poke holes in something, in the sense of saying, well, but yes, but what about? You know, any conversation about festivals, we could have a whole long section about privilege, our privilege to do this. And actually, I am going to do a podcast about privilege because I think it's really important. But I think, you know, there's certain things that, you know, the world is such an imperfect place that there are so many initiatives that, you know, we do our best and we take our thing. Someone once told me that you serve in the way that feeds you most. And I really appreciate that. And when I speak to you, it's like this environmental sustainability initiative through art and play and music, that's how you serve. And so getting into a conversation about, you know, about the privilege of attending, but actually the festival's not that expensive, is it?
It's this year ticket prices now are $250. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I think for what we offer, because we offer so much, you know, it's actually, if you break it down, it's actually quite well priced, I think. Some people even say it's cheap, but depends who you talk to, because for Thailand, you know, it may be expensive for some people still, but we give them the option to do like weekend passes, or even like this year, if they only want to come for Sunday. Then that's much cheaper. That's like $100 or something.
It's nice to do that. It's nice to do a cheap Sunday day and like a family day. I know. There's
just so people can. So they could be exposed. Are you coming this year?
I don't think so. Actually, you know what? I'm definitely not coming, but for a cool reason. I've been asked to do a live podcast at Spotify headquarters in Stockholm. Isn't that cool?
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah. I actually just this week. I got an email from Spotify saying, asking me if I would come and do a live podcast for their, for like their staff. I think it's going to be really big for this show.
Well, oh, wow. Live meaning. So you're going to do one at the Spotify office?
Yeah. I'm going to do one for their holiday party. With,
that's awesome.
Because like, the theme is festivals. And yeah. Spotify's taking podcasts really seriously right now. And so they reached out to me and they were like, hey, we think you'd be great. We're going to fly you out to Sweden.
Do you host your show on Spotify or no?
Yeah. So the way that it works is that you can host it everywhere using your RSS feed. So I'm not sure who's managing your podcast on your team, but I host mine on SoundCloud and then I populate it on Google Play, on iTunes, all that stuff with my RSS feed. So it's definitely on Spotify. There may be people listening to it on Spotify right now in this moment. So a little, wow. Little under the hood, a little bit of how the sausage is made at the end of the podcast.
That's awesome. Well, no, well done. Yeah.
Thanks.
And one question I have for you. So what you listen to a lot of podcasts. What's your favorite podcast?
Tim Ferriss. Okay. I just think he is just, I really like what he's doing. So I listen to a lot of interview style podcasts and Tim Ferriss to me works so hard to create a powerful interview. And I just listened to him and learned. And actually, Tim Ferriss and I both interviewed the same person, which is Chip Conley, my mentor. And it was really incredible. I interviewed Chip first, and then I heard him on Tim Ferriss's podcast. And it was so incredibly valuable for me to listen to a master, because I've been doing this for a year. And I, to listen to an absolute master do exactly the same thing I did and be like, oh, wow, like a really good choice. But he just really researches it a lot. And he's, especially recently, he's been in that health optimization space for a long time. But especially recently, he's like really in like vulnerability, personal growth, talking about depression, talking about deeper things, psychedelic medicine.
That's the key, isn't it? That I think that really is the key. It's like the, you know, the everything starts within. And then once we do that journey, then everything just becomes much more, you know, everything from an interview, from everything, you know, you're coming from that place. So, yeah, no, I can see that. Yeah.
Well, and it's similar. Actually, you were talking about how Wonderfruit was part of your spiritual journey. For me, this podcast is actually really important part of my journey, in part because the podcast is about you. It's not about me. So every week I have a conversation with someone where I learn from them and I'm not talking about myself as much. There's a little bit of Eamon stories and some conversation, but every week I do my very best to make someone that I admire in some way look good. And that's a really powerful practice. And then I share it with an audience. And so, you know, I'm learning and growing and iterating and, you know, it's, you've got Wonderfruit and you're trying things and iterating and getting that experience. It's the same thing I'm doing with Life as a Festival is I'm like, okay, this week we're going to talk about this festival in Thailand. What's going to make this the most compelling for the audience? What's going to make it a home run for you? And that's why I start every podcast being like, hey, what would a home run look like? What do you think would be awesome? And then I'm going to try to help you do it. So like you said, you wanted something conversational and I was like, okay, I'm gonna really focus on that. And that's what I tried to do.
Yeah, you hit a home run.
Hey, and I don't even play sports like ever, but yeah. Well, thanks. It's been such a pleasure to chat with you. And I won't be at Wonderfruit this year, but I would love to come in the future. It's a great festival. I really appreciate getting to speak there. And I really like what you're doing. And I'm really happy that we get to platform you on Life as a Festival.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure as well. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Take care.